taxation number 211281.
Bob Doe, Reel One. Where were you born, please?
In Reigate in Surrey.
Which year was this?
1920.
Can you tell me, first of all, how you came to be in the Air Force, please?
Well, no. I left school when I was 14. My dad was a gardener, and he was working for a man called Sir Emsley Carr, who happened to own a newspaper. And when I left school, my dad asked Emsley Carr if he could find me a job. And he got me a job as an office boy in the News of the World in Fleet Street. And I stayed with them for a few years. And then the government introduced the Volunteer Reserve, where you could learn to fly and they would pay you to learn to fly. And I thought this was wonderful. So I leapt at it and became one of the first 600 people in the Volunteer Reserve. And I learned to fly at Hanworth in Middlesex. And I did about 75 hours flying with them, and I decided that Air Force really was for me, because my dad had been a private in the Army in the First World War, and he used to tell me about things he did, and I decided it was not for me. And so eventually I walked into the old Air Ministry building, which is in Kingsway, and said I wanted to be a pilot in the Air Force, please. And they sent me from office to office, where they found I'd only ever set one exam in my life, which I failed. Until I finished up in front of an elderly bloke, with a lot of scrambled egg on his cap. And I stayed with him for about half an hour, nattering. And he seemed to like me. And eventually said, well, because of your lack of education, you're going to have to sit an exam in the ministry here. Can you come next Wednesday and we'll have it ready for you? He then lent me a book. And he marked a paragraph in this book. He said, learn that paragraph by heart. It was all about the moment of the arm, which I knew nothing about. Anyway, I learned it by heart. And the only question that was at all difficult in this exam was this one question, which I had verbatim. And that's how I became an officer in the Royal Air Force.
Can you tell me about your experiences pre-war, please? The training you had and so on?
Well, pre-war, basic training, I started at Red Hill. And then we went on to Little Risington, Gloucestershire, where I was trained on twin-engined aircraft with the intention of me becoming a heavy bomber pilot. And eventually we finished training there. I was posted to Ascotland in November 1939.
To where?
To Leconfield. And we arrived at Hull Station on a rainy night. We were taken by lorry to Leconfield. We asked the driver what sort of squadron it was. He didn't know. We arrived at mess, which was a wooden hut in those days. And there we met the CO and the two flight commanders. And they didn't know either. And we went down to the hangars the next morning. And the reason we didn't know was that we only had three aircraft, and that was one Gauntlet, which was the forerunner of the Gladiator, one basic training aircraft, and one Magister, which is a fairly modern training aircraft, but the only aircraft that we couldn't possess. So we just flew those around. We then had some Blenheims turn up, which we learned to fly. They then took the Blenheims and sent them to Finland to help them fight the war against Russia. They gave us some battles. This was about the time when battles were being shot down in France like flies. And I wasn't very happy about that. And then one day, about March 1940, a Spitfire landed and taxied over to our hangar. We were told it was ours. We walked around this beautiful thing. We stroked it. We sat in it. I fell in love with this thing. It was beautiful. Next day, 15 more turned up, and we were a fighter squadron. And that's how we became a fire sergeant. But we'd been trained as bombers and knew nothing about normal fire training at all. Anyway, we went flying these. We kept flying until about May when we were ordered down to Cornwall, where we landed at St. Evel in Cornwall, where we stationed. We started doing convoy patrols and night patrols over Plymouth. And then one day we were ordered up to Middle Wallop. This was about beginning of, it's about the 7th or 8th of August, where the battle was going on. And the day we were ordered up to Middle Wallop, the CO and one of the flight commanders disappeared. Left us with one flight commander and a bunch of pilots that we'd all trained together at flying training school.
What had happened to him?
Well, the CO and one flight commander, nothing had happened to them at all. They just walked out. We arrived at Middle Wallop, where we parked far side of the airfield. We got into a lorry to go up to the mess. On the way up to the mess, the airfield was bombed. The hangars were hit, and two of the hangars were knocked down. But our airplanes were perfectly safe because they're far into the airfield. However, we thought this was a good introduction to war. Anyway, we went up to the mess and had a few beers. Forgot about the bombing. Came down and went on state next morning, and shortly after that we were scrambled, which was the first time we ever been scrambled, the first time we'd ever been heading into action. And I was petrified because I always had the feeling I was the worst pilot on the squadron. Also, I was, remember, I trained as a bomber pilot, so I didn't know much about fighter operations. Well, none of us did for that matter. We were all bomber pilots. And anyway, we went off in close formation, which is one thing one never did in war. And we did everything wrong it's possible to do wrong. When you're in close formation, the only person who's looking around is the leader. Everyone else spends all their time formating, which is stupid, because you need all the eyes possible to see the enemy. However, we went up and we then were told then we would be at 15,000 feet. We proceeded to patrol up and down the sun at 15,000 feet, which again is damn stupid. The fact that we were patrolling up and down the sun meant that something like 60% of the time we're in the air, we couldn't see either in front of us or behind us. In fact, on one occasion, we turned from down sun to up sun to find there's only 9 of us left. One of the blokes was found later shot down dead, and the other two landed with their wheels down in France. Anyway, we then carried on up and down, and we suddenly found ourselves in the middle of hundreds of black crosses. We had no idea how we got there. However, there they were, and we broke up rather. Everyone was in every direction imaginable, as you can imagine. And I found myself sitting behind an ME-110. So I settled quietly behind it and shot at it. To my utter surprise, it turned over and went down to the sea. And I was surprised because I thought I was the one who was going to be killed, and I was convinced I was. I was so chuffed that I followed him down, which again is the most stupid thing you can ever do. Again, the quickest way of getting shot down possible. Anyway, I was lucky, I followed him down. On my way down, another one when they decided he was going to shoot me down, so he got behind me. And when I saw my first one crash into the sea, I pulled up sharply, and this one behind me overshot me, and I found I was sitting behind another one. So I shot him down, by which time the air was completely empty, and no airplanes inside at all. Everyone said this is what happens. And so I flew on home. I landed back at base, and the ground crew were very chuffed. And I rather felt pleased myself as well. However, I realised that what had happened would have been sheer luck, because I hadn't seen a thing in the air around me. I had no clue what was happening, and I had to do something about this. So I went to bed early that night, and I worked it out. First of all, I worked out what I was going to do if I saw anything coming past me from behind, because that's where you're going to be shot down from behind, if anything came past. And I reckoned that if I saw anything coming past from behind, I would hit the stick hard, irrespective of what was happening. I wouldn't think about it. I would just hit it hard and go straight down. Although it cut the engine, those days we didn't have negative G carburetors. Although, I mean, the engine would cut dead, at least the quickest direction in which to move. Because any other direction, like pulling up or turning, you stayed in bullet stream for another half second, which was too long. Bullets were quicker than you were. In fact, it saved my life when I did need it. And I worked out that I had to see the enemy before they saw me. In fact, that's the key to surviving in the air. If you see the other bloke first, you live. If he sees you first, you die. And I then worked out how to see the enemy. I realised whatever happened, I wouldn't have to fly in a formation. In fact, it didn't matter, because every time we took off after that, we went off as a gaggle, so I could position myself where I wanted to. And I then started taking interest in the war, because I found that I wasn't dead, and I probably wasn't the worst pilot in the squadron. In fact, I'd done as well as anyone had. And I went off, and I continued to shoot hot airplanes down. Eventually got to the stage where I was so cock-a-hoop that I was wanting to get off and get up and increase my score. And that's stupid, because that's when you start getting into trouble yourself. However, we did very well in 234 Squadron, but after less than 4 weeks, we were moved back out to Middle Wallop to St Devil again, because we only had three of our original pilots remaining. And we really needed to get new pilots and to retrain the squadron. But I was posted back to another squadron at Shaw Bolton, which was next door to the Lord Dedalwallop, where I became a Hurricane pilot, which I'd never flown a Hurricane before. And I operated with the Hurricane squadron for the rest of the Battle of Britain until I was shot down, in fact.
What number was this one?
238. And eventually, in October, on October the 10th, I was flying. I'd been awarded the DFC, so I was flying around with my chest stuck out, which is a stupid thing to do. And on October the 10th, a raid came in at high altitude, which was just on these fighter raids, which is 109s carrying the odd bomb. And it came in quite high up, and we were scrambled to intercept it. There were only four of us in the squadron available, which was stupid, really, because Hurricanes should not have been used at altitude anyway. They were quite incapable of keeping the 109 at altitude. But however, we went off, and we went into cloud, and we climbed up in cloud. We came out about 16, 17,000 feet. By which time I'd lost the other three and they'd disappeared. You can't really stay together in cloud. And an odd property of cloud is that when you're sitting above a cloud looking down into it, you can see another airplane in that cloud, and he's 500 feet in the cloud. You can watch him coming all the way up out of the cloud. But if you're the one in the cloud, you can't see a blind thing until you're totally clear of the cloud. And I came up right underneath this German raid. So I was sitting there rubbing their hands. And as I came out of the cloud, they hit me from in front and behind at the same time, which was very clever. I really don't know how they did it without crashing, but I had proof of that. The first thing I knew was something came over my shoulder into the petrol tank in front, which I didn't like, because I was prepared for it to blow up, which it didn't. I was lucky. And then there's an almighty bang underneath my bottom. And I found out afterwards it was a cannon shell which exploded on my parachute that I was sitting on. And they put a hunk of cannon shell through my right foot, which cut the Achilles tendon, so I was minus one leg. A bullet came through behind, through the armour plating, and finished off in my hand, having broke my watch on the way, which made me very cross. I then got hit on the left shoulder by what seemed like a sledgehammer, and it was a bullet going through from the front to my shoulder. I thought I was dead, and I was due to get married in 2 weeks' time, so I thought, well, that's where he's sat. Well, I wanted to get married, really. I mean, who doesn't when they're a young man? And, well, I then thought, well, damn it, I'm still alive. I ought to really try and get out of this thing. And my reaction when this has happened is I've done what I trained myself to do. I'd hit the stick hard. As a result, I was bunting back into the cloud. So I pulled my foot in my harness to release the straps so I could get out. And they didn't release. The reason they didn't release is I was on an outside bunk, so my weight was holding some harness together. And this, you don't think very clearly when you're under those sort of conditions. And I tried to tear the harness, which is not possible, but I tried to tear it. It eventually released it because they were moving around, and I just fell out of the airplane. What happened to the hood, I had no idea at all. It was probably shot off, I should think. Anyway, I fell out, and falling down through the air, I hadn't opened the parachute at that time, is the most wonderful feeling I know. It's a lovely feeling. Beautiful feeling. Eventually I looked around and decided I ought to do something about getting out, so I managed to get my right hand to the harness and pulled it, and the parachute opened. My almighty thump. And I looked at it. And I saw why I'd had this bang underneath the bottom. Because my parachute was more like a colander than it was a parachute. So I was coming down twice the speed I should have gone down. Anyway, I eventually came out of a cloud and found myself over the most beautiful blue lagoon. I was drifting towards an island in the middle of the glorious lagoon. And the island was Brown Sea Island and the lagoon was Poole Harbour. And in the middle of Brown Sea Island, there's a quagmire which all the drains used to drain into. And I landed in this slap in the middle and landed on my bottom because I only had one leg and one arm. And I knocked myself out. But I came to with my head in a bramble with an Irishman standing over me with the iron bar saying, "What are you?" So I told him in my very basic English what I was, and he was a very good Samaritan. He carried me down to the quay where the Navy sent a picket boat over and they took me over to a hospital in Poole, where they sort of put it all back together again and stitched up the holes. One thing I remember of that most of all is that night there was a bombing raid on Poole Harbour. I thought they were going to get me. I could hear a stick of bombs coming closer and closer to the hospital. Eventually, the last bomb dropping down hit the hospital, but it was only an incendiary bomb. And some brave bloke got rid of it with his dressing gown. But I wasn't really in a very fit state because I had something like gas gangrene or something like that in one of the wounds, probably from the result of sitting in a quagmire. But anyway, I was back flying in early December. I couldn't walk very well or really get into the airplane very well, but the chances of giving me a bunk up, and you could fly perfectly well. The Achilles tendon when it's cut takes an awful long time to heal. And, it must have taken just about a year to heal properly, if not more. And I was back flying in the squadrons, as I say, at the beginning of December. We were on readiness most of Christmas, and then on the 3rd of January 1941, we had a signal from group asking for two volunteers to go up at night. They had the bright idea of on full moon nights, the night either side of full moon, they'd try and put fighters up in the air and vector them into the bomber stream and try and shoot a few down, which was, in principle, a very good idea. So we went off at night, and the two of us went off in different directions. And I went off from Middle Wallop. At least they were controlling me for the night. And I got up about 15,000 feet over the channel. It was January 3rd, remember. There's a layer of snow on the ground. It wasn't very thick, but there was a layer of snow on the ground. There's a solid cloud, thin layer of solid cloud. It was about 2,000 feet. So you've got light from the moon through this cloud, but you couldn't see up into the sky. And the temperature outside was pretty cold. Anyway, I got up to 15,000 feet going out over the channel. And my instruments started doing stupid things. I mean, my oil pressure gauge stayed constant, but the oil temperature started going up. Now, that doesn't make sense. It can't happen. So I just, my first reaction was to open the radiator, which I shouldn't have done. I should have shut it and boiled it up, because what had happened, I was the first case of coring, which is where the oil freezes in the oil freezer, oil cooler. But anyway, I rang up the Middle Wallop and told them what had happened. And as far as I knew, I didn't know what had happened, but the engine wasn't right. So they gave me a course to steer back to Warmore, which was on the nearest airfield on the coast. And they said they'd get the duty pilot on duty, send up some rockets, let me know where they were. And I said, thank you, and I headed back, and then I lost contact in the Middle Wallop at about 10,000 feet, because there's quite a long way away from them. And then at that stage, the engine packed up altogether, and a large cloud of sparks came past me, and I just glided on down in very dead quietness. I eventually came down to this layer of cloud, and I went through it. When I came out of the cloud, I was slap over the middle of Warmore, which is absolutely brilliant. They couldn't have done a better job. But there weren't any rockets coming up or anything like that. But I could see it because of the snow on the ground. I could see the outline of the airfield. And the way the airfield was planned, you had hangars at one end, and there was a wood at the other end. But I thought I'd sooner go over the hangars and into the wood than over the wood and into the hangars. So I came round and I just saw the loom of the hangars go past on the left, and I realised I was safe. And I kept the speed up to 160 in case I misjudged it, because I knew you could put a hurricane down at that speed and walk away from it. And so I then put it down. Well, since I'd been there, they'd been bombed. And because they'd been bombed, they had a whole heap of rocks thrown in or brought in to help them repair the holes in the runway in the airfield. And I went slap into this heap of rocks. Something else broke. I was thrown forward. My face was knocked off on the gun sight, and one of my arms was broken. But I wasn't knocked out. I remember looking up at the sky, and as I looked up, it slowly went dark. This was my face swelling, obviously. And I put my good arm up to the head, you know, we tend to do when anything like that happens. And, I felt my nose stuck up on top of my head, which I thought wasn't quite right. However, about that time, two blokes turned up and they started pulling me out of the plane. And the one of them dived down between the legs because my feet were trapped underneath the rudder bars, apparently. But anyway, they got them free and started heaving me out. And they tore my trousers as they pulled me out, which made me very mad because these were the only decent pair of trousers I possessed. Being a very skimp PO, you couldn't afford to wear as fast as I couldn't. And anyway, they got me as far as the sick quarters. In those days, the nursing sister used to be on duty at sick quarters at the beginning of the war. I remember this beautiful, motherly voice. And she got hold of my hand, and this was wonderful. I then passed out. And apparently, it took them a good half an hour to try and get her hand out of mine. But however, that's all right. And they then took me to the local college hospital, which is Warmore. They didn't have any doctors on duty at the hospital, but they did have an army division stationed very close, and the army doctors were on call to the hospital. They called in one of the army surgeons who operated on me, because I'd had an eye knocked out and this sort of thing, and he put everything back where he thought it ought to go, and he stitched this bit of nose back on, and put some drainage tubes in, and that sort of thing, and put me to bed. They couldn't do much more. I came to, I don't know, actually 10, 11 the next morning, I suppose, with a trainee nurse sitting beside the bed. Her idea, the idea was that she should stop me choking while I'd be doing it, came around the man's setting. And she started talking, and she kept me occupied, chatting quite happily away. But the only topic of a conversation was that Lawrence of Arabia had died in this bed. I didn't really appreciate that too much. However, they kept me there for a couple of days. Then eventually I was sent to the lunatic asylum. Now, the lunatic asylum was Park Prue in Basingstoke. At the end of the First World War, two surgeons started this technique of rebuilding faces, facio-maxillary. And they tossed up at the end of the First World War, and the loser agreed to carry on the technique after the war. And a man called Gillies lost the toss. And he was given a wing of a lunatic asylum, Park Prue, Basingstoke, which continue his techniques of rebuilding faces. And he tells lovely stories about how the latest Open Golf Champion of 1930-something came to him very embarrassed and said her boobs were interfering with her swing. Could he do something about it? He tells how he removes a layer of fat and all this sort of thing. He says, that wasn't the end of it. 3 years later, she came back and said, please could I put it back? She'd got engaged. He used to make money by giving lectures. He was +2 golfer as well. He used to give demonstrations where he got beautiful models to lie down on the tee. He'd drive a golf ball off their forehead and this sort of thing. He was quite a man. He was a brilliant man. He had an assistant at that time called Mackindale. Anyway, Gillies operated on me. I was there. I had done 27 operations on my face and everything else. And eventually came the time when they had to give my nose some shape. Because up that stage, just with skin kept alive by being stitched down. And he brought a book of noses round to me and a bottle of scotch. Scotch at that time was like gold dust. And he got me to ask for the only nose he knew he could give me, which is brilliant psychology. Brilliant. And this is what resulted. And it's just solid bone. I walked into a door the next day, so this bone is not attached anymore, it's loose. But it still works. But the one person I think deserved decoration that time more than anyone else was there's a pub called the Red Lion in Basingstoke. Which is one of the nicest pubs in the main part of the town. There's a big, busty, blonde barmaid in there. And we were encouraged, because Gillies had understood this business about what we called hospitalitis, where you put up with so much in the way of operations, and you eventually came to the stage where you do anything rather than avoid an operation. And so he encouraged us to go out and act normally, into the pubs and have a beer. And you have the blokes over there with pedicles, you know, with their skin been taken from their forehead and hanging down over their face. You used to go out like that to the pub. And there's this big, busty blonde barmaid in the Red Lion. And with this ghastly bunch of people, they really were a ghastly sight. We always just go in there with half a dozen of us. You see people sort of edging away. You know, they didn't mean to, but they did. And you began to feel very bad about this. And she would say, hello, my darlings, how are you? And give us all a kiss. She deserved decoration, that woman, if anyone ever did. So she was wonderful. Anyway, I eventually decided I'd better go back flying again. So in May, I went back flying. Well, before I went back to flying in May, you had to have a full medical, flying medical. And mine was the phoniest thing that ever happened. Because all examinations, eye examinations in the Air Force those days, were done at eye level. I'd had an eye knocked out, but it was working. But what I could, anything above level, I could see two of everything, because my eyes were like that. One was, so you didn't really see them at all. You saw two of everything above eye level. But that eye level, my eyes were perfect. So, it was a pretty phony medical exam. Anyway, I went back, became flight commander in 66 squadron, and I spent a couple of years.
What were they armed with?
Hmm?
What were they flying?
Spitfires.
And what...